KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1.
From New York, this is Democracy Now! Explosions rocked the live broadcast of Iranian state TV yesterday after Israel bombed station headquarters. Meanwhile, President Trump has left the G7 summit early and returned to Washington, telling Iranians everyone should leave Tehran. Then to Minnesota, where the alleged assassin of former State House Speaker has been arraigned on federal and state charges. We'll speak with Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison.
She was a powerful political leader and a good person because she understood some basic things about life in our society. She understood that everyone is entitled to due process. She understood that kids learn better on a full stomach, so she fought for universal school meals.
Then we speak to Cuba's deputy foreign minister. He just addressed the UN General Assembly yesterday. We'll talk to him about the U.S. travel ban, reported U.S. plans to send more immigrants to Guantanamo, and the U.S. embargo.
The time allotted is not enough to describe the magnitude and scope of the United States' economic war against Cuba. It is not enough to explain the way it hinders our economic policies, the efforts it demands from our authorities to guarantee the country's vitality under such aggressive pressure.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel bombed the headquarters of Iranian state television Monday in the latest escalation of Israel's war on Iran. Israel also assassinated another top Iranian official, Iran's new wartime chief of staff, Ali Shadmani. The bombing of Iranian state TV occurred during a live broadcast that was cut short as the studio began to fill with dust after the blast.
What you observed, what you heard, this dust in the air.
The news anchor left her seat at the Iranian state broadcaster as the room filled with smoke. Three employees of Iranian state TV were reportedly killed. The Committee to Protect Journalists said it was appalled by the Israeli attack. The group's Middle East representative, Sarah Kuda, said, quote, Israel's killing with impunity of almost 200 journalists in Gaza has emboldened it to target media elsewhere in the region, unquote. Many residents of Tehran are attempting to leave the city as Israel attacks the city for a fifth day. On Monday, three Red Crescent workers were killed while responding to an Israeli airstrike in the capital. Israel claims its, quote, full aerial operational control over Tehran. On Monday, President Trump wrote online, everyone should immediately evacuate Tehran, exclamation point. Iran is also continuing to fire missiles at Israel. On Monday, a major Israeli oil refinery in Haifa was shut down after being hit by a missile. Meanwhile, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is refusing to rule out assassinating Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. He was questioned by ABC's Jonathan Carl.
The president flatly rejected a plan, an opportunity that the Israelis had to take out the supreme leader. Do you understand his concern? My understanding is his concern is that this would escalate the conflict beyond where it is already.
It's not going to escalate the conflict. It's going to end the conflict.
On Monday, leaders of the G7, including President Trump, signed a statement calling for a, quote, de-escalation of hostilities in the Middle East, unquote, while also affirming Israel's right to defend itself, even though Israel launched the initial unprovoked attack on Iran. Trump left the G7 summit in Canada a day early. On his flight back to Washington, D.C., he told reporters he's seeking a, quote, real end to conflict, not a ceasefire. Trump said, quote, Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon. It's very simple, unquote. Trump also criticized French President Emmanuel Macron, who had said Trump left the G7 to negotiate a ceasefire. Meanwhile, Reuters reports the U.S. military has moved a large number of Air Force refueling aircraft to Europe. The U.S. aircraft carrier Nimitz is also heading to the Middle East. On Monday, Democratic Senator Tim Kaine introduced a war powers resolution to require Trump seek authorization from Congress before attacking Iran. Al Jazeera reports Israeli attacks have killed at least 74 people in Gaza since dawn, including 56 Palestinians seeking humanitarian aid in Khan Yunis. Many were killed by Israeli tank fire. On Monday, another 38 aid seekers were killed, fueling growing international condemnation of the shadowy U.S.-Israel-backed aid operation. Anna Halford of Doctors Without Borders described it as, quote, neither a humanitarian enterprise nor a system. This is basically lethal chaos, she said. U.N. Human Rights Chief Volker Turk has accused Israel of, quote, inflicting horrifying, unconscionable suffering on Palestinians, unquote. Meanwhile, French Palestinian European Parliament member Rima Hassan criticized her fellow lawmakers for remaining silent after she and 11 others were detained by Israel while attempting to deliver aid to Gaza as part of the Gaza Freedom Flotilla.
As long as this parliament is silent, Europe will no longer be a voice for human rights, but the echo of its own complicity and political cowardice. June 8th, I was kidnapped at sea internationally by the Israeli army while I was on board a humanitarian ship on the way to Gaza. There were 12 of us on board the ship, including 10 European citizens. All have been kidnapped, deported by Israel, and illegally detained for several days. In a deafening silence of this parliament, no condemnation. No call for unconditional release. I was handcuffed, searched naked, handcuffed hands and feet. I was put in solitary confinement for having written Free Palestine in my cell.
In news from Ukraine, a massive Russian missile and drone assault on Kyiv has killed at least 14 people and wounded over 50 more. Local officials say it was one of the largest attacks on the Ukrainian capital since Russia invaded in 2022. Authorities report 30 apartments were destroyed in a single residential block. One U.S. citizen died from shrapnel wounds. In a separate strike, a Russian attack on the port city of Odessa injured 13 more people. The assault came as the Ukrainian president, Volodymyr Zelensky, headed to the G7 talks in Canada. In Minnesota, federal and state officials have announced murder and stalking charges against Vance Belter, the man accused of assassinating Democratic State House leader Melissa Horthman and her husband and their home, as well as shooting State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette. Joseph Thompson is acting U.S. Attorney for Minnesota.
Political assassinations are rare. They strike at the very core of our democracy. But the details of Belter's crime are even worse. They are truly chilling. It is no exaggeration to say that his crimes are the stuff of nightmares. Belter stalked his victims like prey. He went to their homes, held them out as a police officer, and shot them in cold blood.
Authorities say Belter visited the homes of two other lawmakers on the night of the killings. They also discovered a hit list that included Planned Parenthood centers and the names of many Democratic politicians, including Minnesota Senators Tina Smith and Amy Klobuchar, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, and State Attorney General Keith Ellison, who will join us later on the program. On Monday, Senator Smith confronted Republican Senator Mike Lee after he blamed the political left for the shooting. In one post, the Utah senator wrote, quote, "This is what happens when Marxists don't get their way," unquote. The Department of Homeland Security has instructed immigration agents to continue raiding farms, hotels, and restaurants, reversing a call by President Trump just days ago to exempt those industries. The Washington Post reports Trump advisor Stephen Miller opposed making any exceptions for specific industries, despite warnings from business leaders about the economic fallout of the raids. Meanwhile, federal agents are continuing to carry out raids in and around Los Angeles. On Saturday, dozens of armed, masked agents raided a popular flea market outside Los Angeles. In Georgia, a prominent Spanish-language journalist is facing possible deportation after being arrested while covering Saturday's No Kings protests. Mario Guevara, who was live-streaming the demonstration, was taken into custody despite clearly identifying as a journalist. Originally from El Salvador, he's built a large following for his reporting on anti-ICE protests. According to The Guardian, a municipal judge released him on bond Monday, but jail officials then said he would be transferred to ICE custody. A New York Supreme Court judge has blocked New York City Mayor Eric Adams from going ahead with his plan to allow ICE to reopen an office at the Rikers Island Jail complex. Judge Mary Rosato sided with the New York City Council in its argument that Adams likely gave ICE the green light for the Rikers Island office in exchange for Trump's Justice Department dropping its corruption case against the mayor. In Mexico, 9 newly elected Supreme Court justices received their certificates of victory following Mexico's first-ever judicial elections in May. The incoming head of the Supreme Court is Hugo Aguilar Ortiz, a Mixtec indigenous lawyer from Oaxaca, who becomes the first indigenous person to hold Mexico's highest judicial office. Ortiz spoke during the election certification ceremony.
The days when our words, our requests, and even our mere presence were met with ridicule and discrimination in these very institutions are now behind us. Thank you for everything. The history of Mexico cannot be understood without considering the participation of indigenous and Afro-Mexican peoples at various moments of transformation. The electoral process we are now completing was no exception. I'm confident that this is the beginning of the full inclusion of indigenous and Afro-Mexican peoples in the public life of our country.
Mexico's judicial election turned out just 13% of eligible voters. It came following hotly contested reforms last year. Judges aligned with the ruling Morena Party dominated the election, including the makeup of the Mexico Supreme Court. The Guardian's reporting health workers at the Department of Veterans Affairs could refuse treatment to patients who are Democrats, unmarried, or based on their national origin due to the VA's revised bylaws. Those were changed to conform with President Trump's anti-trans executive order, according to the report. And the new guidelines also apply to hiring practices, effectively allowing for employment discrimination. The White House has denied the report. The VA is the country's largest integrated hospital system with over 26,000 doctors serving 9 million patients each year. All 50 states, Washington, D.C., and 4 U.S. territories have signed on to a $7.4 billion settlement with Purdue Pharma, the maker of OxyContin. The deal has reportedly also been approved by the Sackler family, owners of Purdue. If finalized, the settlement will go towards resolving thousands of victim lawsuits against Purdue. It'll also help fund addiction treatment, prevention, and recovery programs. Under the deal, the Sacklers will lose control over Purdue. The deal also does not shield the Sacklers from future opioid settlements, which they had previously fought for. Over 850,000 people have died from opioid-related overdoses in the United States since 1999. And the NAACP has announced it will not invite President Trump to its upcoming national convention in Charlotte, North Carolina. This marks the first time the organization's opted to exclude a sitting president in its 116-year history. NAACP President Derek Johnson said, quote, "Our mission is to advance civil rights, and the current president has made clear that his mission is to eliminate civil rights, he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York with Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Israel bombed the headquarters of Iranian state television Monday in the latest escalation of Israel's five-day war. Israel also assassinated another top Iranian official, Iran's wartime chief of staff, Ali Shadmani. The bombing of Iranian state TV occurred while the station was live on the air.
What you observed, what you heard, this dust in the air.
The news host who was anchoring jumped up out of her seat as smoke filled the studio. Three employees of Iranian state TV were reportedly killed in the Israeli attack. Speaking from outside the burning building with what appears to be blood on his hands, an Iranian state TV reporter described the attack.
I was on the first floor when the bombing happened. I don't know how many of my colleagues were martyred or how many were injured. They had told us to evacuate the area, but everyone stayed until the last moment to show the world the image of Iran's power, something the Zionist regime doesn't want. This is the result of their miscalculation. Did they think hitting the IRIB would achieve anything? They will see worse.
And President Trump is back in prime minister, and we're going to turn to President Trump is back in Washington, D.C., after cutting short his trip to Canada for the G7 summit, citing concerns about the conflict in the Middle East. Earlier Monday, he said on social media, everyone should immediately evacuate Tehran. Late Monday night, the Group of Seven released a statement expressing support for Israel and calling Iran a source of instability, as well as calling for a broader de-escalation in the region. President Trump signed the statement after initially declining to do so. Speaking to reporters aboard Air Force One, President Trump told reporters Iran cannot have a nuclear weapon and said, quote, I'm not too much in the mood to negotiate now.
I've been negotiating. I told them to do the deal. They should have done the deal. Their cities have been blown to pieces. I've lost a lot of people. They should have done the deal. I told them to do the deal. So I don't know. I'm not too much in a mood to negotiate now.
Meanwhile, the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, has refused to rule out the assassination of the Iranian supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. This is what he said on ABC, speaking to reporter Jonathan Carl.
The president flatly rejected a plan, an opportunity that the Israelis had to take out the supreme leader. Do you understand his concern? My understanding is his concern is that this would escalate the conflict beyond where it is already.
And it's not going to escalate the conflict. It's going to end the conflict.
For more, we're joined by two guests. Nagar Mordzevi is an Iranian-American journalist, host of the Iran podcast, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy, joining us from Washington, D.C. And Ori Goldberg, an Israeli political analyst and scholar who's written extensively on Iran, Israel, and the relationship between religion and politics in the Middle East. His latest op-ed for Al Jazeera is headlined, The Real Reason Israel Attacked Iran. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Nagar Mordzevi, I want to begin with you. You have this chilling warning from the president of the United States as he cuts short his meeting at the G7, comes back to the Situation Room in Washington, D.C., and says all should leave Tehran. We're talking about millions of people. What are you hearing on the ground as we watch the news host jump out of her seat as her studio at Iran State Television was bombed?
Amy, I can say everyone I've spoken to is in shock and horror. First of all, people didn't expect this coming from day one. And as your reporting has shown, from day one, civilians have also been the target, even though the attacks were framed as an attack on Iran's nuclear program, political, military target. That wasn't only the case in civilian homes, residences, sometimes of the commanders, but also neighbors. Entire buildings sometimes have been targeted, and the civilian toll on the Iranian side is very high and keeps rising. There's also a civilian toll on the Israeli side. I'm sure you're going to talk about that. So far, it's over 200 people killed in these attacks in Iran, and most of them civilians, 1,500 injured. So it's a horror. And also in Tehran, this directive essentially coming from President Trump, we don't know what to make of it. How can a city, a metropolis of 10 million people suddenly evacuate, and to where? I mean, this is, we're talking about women, children, the disabled, elderly, sick people. How can people just get up and go? The very few, and I would say maybe the lucky few who have homes or family or access to places outside of Tehran who have tried to leave the city in the past few days have been stuck in very, very congested traffic of roads trying to get out of the city. And gas stations have very long lines. I've spoken to someone who was trying to go to a city north of Tehran that normally takes a three-hour drive. They had to wait in a gas station for about 6 hours just to fill up a tank, and then an overnight trip of about 12 hours for a road that would normally take 3 hours. And this is before the Israeli directive for people to evacuate an entire neighborhood, and then President Trump's post that says everyone should leave Tehran. So it's going to create chaos, mayhem. I don't even know if a lot of people are taking this seriously. The government is not taking this very much seriously. They have put out some directives for people to go to metro stations or mosques or take shelter in places. But I think even the government themselves, they're in shock. And they haven't been really dealing with this in a proper way. And the country's air defenses don't seem to be able to intercept enough of the attacks coming. And the attacks also, part of it is domestic, coming from inside Iran, car bombs going off, or these sort of infiltration stations that are being discovered, where essentially Israeli agents are conducting some of these missions from inside the country. So it's absolute mayhem. It's a horror show. People are shocked, they're horrified, and they don't know what to do.
Yes, I wanted to ask you, Nagar, in the U.S. press, one word we do not hear in the commercial press is that this is an unprovoked attack of the Israeli government. We heard that often when in the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, almost every mention was of the unprovoked invasion. To your understanding, what did Iran do to cause Israel to launch this attack?
Well, this is a great point you're making, both in the statement of political leaders of the West, and also that trickles down, I think, to the media coverage. You see a very clear bias and sort of a double standard or hypocrisy, if you may, on how they deal with these different situations, sort of the international rules-based order, the laws of war, and how you frame these things. So from the beginning, the Israelis were framing their attack as a preemptive attack. A preemptive attack has a meaning in international law. It means the enemy was about to imminently attack you any minute, and you discovered that, and you try to preempt that by attacking first. And the Israelis haven't produced that evidence. In fact, just today, I think, reporting was coming that U.S. intelligence is saying, no, Iran's nuclear program remains a civilian, and they did not have the plan to weaponize this. The Israelis are saying they were about to build nuclear weapons and then hit Israel for it. Yes, Iran has enough uranium-enriched fissile material to potentially build a bomb if they decide to weaponize the program. But there are so many ifs on the way, and to call that a preemptive strike on an imminent threat is just something that we haven't seen evidence for. And unfortunately, the media and the press, as you said, many legacy media are just following that line. It's a disservice to their audiences, to people, you know, around the world, especially in the West, whose countries, whose tax dollars, whose government's policies are very much involved and fueling the conflict in the region.
And in following up on this issue of Israel's claim that Iran is near building a nuclear weapon, isn't there a longstanding fatwa of the Iranian clergy against Iran developing a nuclear bomb?
There's a fatwa against developing nuclear bomb by the supreme leader, who's also a religious leader. And there's also longstanding policy. And more important than that, if people don't trust the Iranian side, U.S. intelligence reporting has time and again shown that Iran's nuclear program remains civilian. And I think the irony here that we need to point out is that the Iranians have said before, senior officials, that if the homeland gets attacked and if the nuclear program gets attacked, then their decision-making and their policy may actually shift. They have signaled that publicly. So while the program remains civilian, in the long term, if they decide to make that shift into a weaponized program, we can thank these attacks, Benjamin Netanyahu, essentially, for going after a program that used to be civilian and can potentially, shift the policy in the future and weaponize it. But right now, I mean, U.S. intelligence has just reaffirmed Iranian policy publicly. And then also, as you said, that religious decree, which is an important thing as well.
Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth was asked about growing tensions in Iran in an interview with Fox News Monday. This is what he said.
The president's, as he said today, his position has not changed. What you're watching in real time is peace through strength and America first. Our job is to be strong. We are postured defensively in the region to be strong in pursuit of a peace deal. And we certainly hope that's what happens here. And America first means we're going to defend American personnel and American interests. So when you see jets and you see air defense assets and counter UAS assets, that's because my job as the Secretary of Defense is to ensure that our people are safe and that we're strong so that we can set the conditions for a deal. And President Trump's made it clear it's on the table. The question is whether Iran will take it.
On Monday, Iran called on President Trump to force a ceasefire. This is a reporter questioning Trump.
Have you heard any signals or seen any messages from intermediaries that Iran wishes to de-escalate the conflict?
Yeah.
What have you heard? What have you heard from the Iranians?
They'd like to talk, but they should have done that before. I had 60 days, and they had 60 days. And on the 61st day, I said, we don't have a deal. They have to make a deal. And it's painful for both parties, but I'd say Iran is not winning this war. And they should talk, and they should talk immediately before it's too late.
And what would you say, in your opinion, what would it take for the U.S. to get involved in this conflict militarily?
I don't want to talk about that.
So President Trump is back in Washington, called a meeting in the Situation Room. I want to bring Ori Goldberg into this conversation, an Israeli political analyst who's written extensively about Iran. He's speaking to us from Tel Aviv, wrote a piece in Al Jazeera headlined, "The Real Reason Israel Attacked Iran." Ori, what is that reason?
The reason, I think, is Netanyahu's desperate attempt, last chance attempt, if you will, to draw the world's attention away from Gaza. Real reason Israel attacked Iran is that Israel has reached the end of its rope and has exhausted all of its options in Gaza. Israel cannot make any sort of progress in Gaza. It keeps on killing Palestinians regularly, which is the only thing that it is at its disposal. And I think Netanyahu felt the global sentiment shifting on Gaza. I think he saw the potential reversal of his fortunes with regard to what Israel was doing in the Gaza Strip. And because of that, he attacked Iran. To continue Ms. Mortazavi's point, the notion that this was a preemptive strike is ridiculous. Obviously, this has been planned for long months, perhaps even years, and this was carried out precisely at the right moment that was deemed fortuitous for reasons of political timing. It seems that there is no serious intelligence outfit in the world, and that includes both the American DNI and Israeli Mossad, that assessed Iran's nuclear situation as an imminent threat. That, I think, only stresses this point further. Netanyahu did not go to war with Iran because he sensed a window of opportunity to decrease the threat to Israel. Netanyahu went to war with Iran because of Gaza.
Ori Goldberg, would you say it's fair to say that the imminent threat was not Iran developing a nuclear bomb, which, of course, Israel has. But Iran and the U.S. were perhaps about to negotiate this nuclear deal, very similar to the one President Obama negotiated with Iran.
I think you're absolutely right. I think Israel at the moment defines its security as continuing to enjoy absolute and total impunity, as the ability to shoot at and kill whoever Israel wants, wherever Israel wants, whenever Israel wants, for as long as it wants, without paying any kind of price. I think that the potential agreement between the United States and Iran would have spoiled that tremendously. I think Israel is attempting to operate as a disruptor throughout the Middle East. Any kind of longstanding, obliging agreement that would perhaps settle the very volatile political climate, the most threatening one for the security of Israel, as I now defined it, would have been an agreement between the United States and Iran.
And Ori, what about the impact of this Netanyahu decision on the popular protest movement against him within Israel? As a result of these attacks now, basically the population is forced to shelter in place.
Well, I just read an interesting Facebook post this morning where this young man who was, I think, a senior operative in the protests said, all you people who think that this is simple, that we shouldn't go to war, or that we should destroy all of our enemies at once, you should realize that reality is complex. And I think I'm quoting directly when I say he wrote, "This war is the essence of Zionism or the purpose of Zionism. But on the other hand, we are against this vile government. For now, we have a war to win. So it's not time for sowing propaganda and dissent against the government." I think that's a very popular attitude, especially among the people who protested against Netanyahu. Israelis are known for rallying around the flag. I would say that Netanyahu's conviction that should he begin a war with Iran, his political support would skyrocket. I think that's proved to be quite wise on his part, certainly for the short term. Iran is the most broad consensus there is in Israeli politics. For at least a generation, Israelis have grown up with an official narrative saying that all Iran is interested in is the apocalyptic destruction of Israel, that Iran is religiously committed to it, that its leaders are preaching it every day in the mosques, and that ordinary Iranians, and here there's a bit of a schizophrenic approach to Iran, ordinary Iranians on the one hand are resisting their religious rulers, but on the other hand, this is what they hear all the time. So one can count on Iran to do everything it can to destroy Israel when the window presents itself. This means that anybody who goes to war against Iran, especially after 2 years of abject shame and failure in Gaza, the Israeli genocidal campaign in Gaza was not a success as far as most Israelis are concerned. After 2 years of this abject failure, Israel is very thirsty for a quote-unquote win. The first night of Israel's war with Iran was spectacular tactically, and a lot of Israelis are now, I don't want to say jubilant, because as you say, not only are we sheltering in place, but the entire fabric of life of this country has been tremendously disturbed. Israelis are not jubilant, but Israelis, most of them, the great majority of them, are saying this is the most just war Israel has ever fought, and we should continue fighting it. Just as a last point, that phrase, the most just war Israel has ever fought, was exactly the same phrase used to justify Israel's actions in Gaza. The assassinations that Israel is carrying out in Iran right now are precisely the MO Israel used in Gaza. Israel is, in effect, trying to destroy Hamas in Tehran.
And what is your sense of how the Iranians have responded so far, and what might be a way to achieve some kind of ceasefire and truce here?
According to IDF assessments, more than 90% of the Iranian missiles were targeted at military sites. In Israel, military sites are very much a part of the civilian lay of the land. despite Israeli accusations against Hamas that this is a horrible crime. I think the Iranians so far have responded well within their means. They've not gone overboard. They've not staged some kind of suicide attack in response to Israel's strike. I think the Iranians are trying to pace themselves. I think they're saving a lot for potential escalation. But I get the sense that the Iranians are quite ready to sit down and talk. The political decision that needs to be made is one that needs to be made in Jerusalem. I don't know if Israel is capable at this stage of making such a decision. Netanyahu is very much high on his own supply. He feels invigorated. He feels he has re-won the support of the people. This should come from the outside. The talks, ceasefire, potential de-escalation, as the G7 leaders call it, this should be superimposed from the outside. I don't see the Israeli public, and certainly not Israel's leadership, making such an independent decision at this time.
Ori Goldberg, we want to thank you so much for being with us, a Israeli political analyst in Tel Aviv. We will link to your piece about the real reason you believe Israel attacked Iran. And I want to thank Negar Mutazevi, who is an Iranian-American journalist. Her podcast is The Iran Podcast. She's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. When we come back, we go to Minnesota, where the alleged assassin of former State House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband has been arraigned on federal and state charges. We'll speak with one of the people on the hit list of the assassin. We'll speak with Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison. Stay with us.
I've been thinking about greed.
Greed is a poison rising in the land. The soul of the people twisted in its command. It moves like a virus, seeking out
greed by Sweet Honey in the Rock in our old firehouse studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to Minnesota, where federal and state officials have announced murder and stalking charges against Vance Bilter, the suspect accused of assassinating Democratic State House Speaker Melissa Hortman and her husband in their home, as well as for shooting State Senator John Hoffman and his wife, Yvette. Joseph Thompson is acting U.S. Attorney for Minnesota.
Political assassinations are rare. They strike at the very core of our democracy. But the details of Bilter's crime are even worse. They are truly chilling. It is no exaggeration to say that his crimes are the stuff of nightmares. Bilter stalked his victims like prey. He went to their homes, held them out as a police officer, and shot them in cold blood.
Authorities say Bilter first shot the Hoffmans multiple times, then went to two other lawmakers' homes. One wasn't home before he then killed the House Speaker Emerita and her husband. They also discovered a hit list that included Planned Parenthood centers and the names of many Democratic politicians, including Minnesota Senator Tina Smith and Amy Klobuchar, and Congresswoman Ilhan Omar. A vigil was held Monday in Brooklyn Park, Minnesota, to honor the victims. After the shootings, many recommended the Minneapolis No Kings rally Saturday be canceled, since No Kings signs were found in the suspect's car. And people were concerned that since he was still on the loose on Saturday, he could attack the protests. But thousands gathered anyway on the state capitol steps, including one of the Democratic officials on the hit list, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison.
She was a powerful political leader and a good person because she understood some basic things about life in our society. She understood that everyone is entitled to due process. She understood that kids learn better on a full stomach, so she fought for universal school meals.
Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison joins us now for more. Attorney General, our deepest condolences to you, to Minnesota. So many across the political spectrum loved the state House Speaker Emerita, Melissa Hortman, and her husband. If you can talk about who she was and also the charges that have been brought against the alleged assassin.
Well, I met her before either one of us were in politics. Melissa Hortman was a legal aid lawyer. When I met her, she was representing a tenant, African-American woman, mother of three, who had been the target of discrimination and abuse by her landlord. It was alleged that the landlord would say things like, hey, girls don't have to pay rent if they're nice. And this particular tenant was very lucky to have Melissa Hortman as her lawyer, who fought and won a very large judgment against this landlord. I actually represented that same client in another matter. And so Melissa and I got to know each other. I went to the state legislature. She went, and we got to be really good friends. And she was always on the right side of the issues, had a strong moral compass, but was always pragmatic and willing to reach across the aisle and try to come up with some solutions that work for everyone. And she rose to the level of speaker. I went on to the U.S. Congress, as you know, Amy, and I got to admit, I tried to convince her to run in the 3rd Congressional District, but she said, no, I'm here in Minnesota. I'm going to stay here in Minnesota and serve the state of Minnesota. I don't have any aspirations for Washington. And she did a wonderful job. She helped lead on the issue of the child tax credit, universal school meals, driver's license for everybody, paid sick and family leave in the state of Minnesota, and also expansions in health care, prescription drug pricing. She just was dedicated to trying to make people's lives easier, and she was pretty effective at it. She also knew that sometimes she had to take the hard vote, and she did, because she knew she had to land that budget negotiation. But right up until we lost her, she was fiercely fighting for people, always polite, always kind. And by the way, she was really funny, and she had a smile that would light up any room. But she had a great sense of humor, was sort of a joker, and could lighten the mood with her sense of humor. I just am really going to miss her, and I know everybody will here. We loved her. She was the best.
Well, Attorney General, could you talk to us about this climate of political violence, not only in your state, but that has been spreading the past few years across the country, and what can be done to change that?
Well, one, you and I and Amy all will remember what happened to Paul Pelosi, a horrific attack on him in Nancy Pelosi's home. We'll remember as far back as even the Murrah building bombing in 1995. We will remember, and these are domestic attacks. And then, I mean, to add to it, just the rhetoric of the president is very violent, and it opens the door for the jostling and throwing around of Senator Padilla, not to mention the threats against Governor Newsom and Mayor Bass, not to mention the unlawful arrest of Mayor Baraka, the Trump, what I believe are trumped up charges against Congresswoman McIver. And it just sort of creates this ugly environment. When he says, in the old days, we used to, you know, beat them and all this kind of stuff, I'll pay for anybody's lawyer who attacks somebody. This is unprecedented for any president. In the past, presidents used to try to calm people. On both sides of the aisle, they never would inflame the bad impulses of people. Not this president. He's all for it. And he's been the target of some of this political violence. And he also has fed the political violence. And we see it, you know.
Of course, you mentioned, you know, You mentioned Paul Pelosi being hit over the head with a hammer, and Donald Trump Jr. was mocking him at the time, mocking him for that attack. You now have the Democratic Senator Tina Smith of Minnesota confronting her colleague, Republican Senator Mike Lee, over his post on social media about the Minnesota shootings, in which he wrote, quote, "This is what happens when Marxists don't get their way," next to a picture of the alleged gunman shooter. If you can respond to this and then just very quickly tell us about the state and federal charges that have been brought against Vance Belter.
Well, Senator Lee owes America an apology. I hope that he has the courage to admit that he was very wrong. Tina Smith was absolutely right to confront him, and I'm proud of her for that. And let me just say the charges, both state and federal, are appropriate. He violated state laws. He violated federal laws. The state laws are murder. The grand jury will be reviewing first-degree murder charges against this individual and the federal charges, because the crime employed the use of interstate wire and internet and other things. It's appropriate federal charges as well, and he's going to be charged in both. Which ones will go first? Which trial will proceed first? I don't know. That's probably in a negotiation between state and federal authorities. Both are very well represented. That's actually not going to be my case unless something changes. The state will be represented by Hennepin County Attorney's Office, which is very able to do a good job in this matter. And so investigators are gathering evidence. We urge people, if you know something about this case, please come forward and share it. We must stop political violence. We can argue about our political differences, but in this country, we're supposed to settle political differences at the ballot box, in a courtroom, or in peaceful protests, but never with murderous violence like this. It's completely unacceptable. And I would ask the president to stop his violent rhetoric and call Americans to the better place without changing any of his political views. We just need him to call us to a more peaceful disposition of our conflicts, which are legitimate differences of point of view.
Keith Ellison, want to thank you for being with us, Minnesota Attorney General. Up next, Cuba's deputy foreign minister joins us to talk about the travel ban, the reported U.S. plans to send thousands more immigrants to Guantanamo, and the U.S. embargo against Cuba. Back in 20 seconds.
Una canción de amor esta noche. Es lo que yo te quiero entregar para que solo tú le retoces para romperla luego de amar.
Cuban musician Silvio Rodriguez performing at Central Park here in New York, its summer stage in 2017. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at the Trump administration's tightening restrictions on Cuba, with the island nation among a dozen countries on Trump's travel ban that went into effect last week. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, a former Florida Republican senator whose parents were born in Cuba, has spearheaded Trump's attacks on Cuba as a leading supporter of the decades-old economic embargo against the island nation. On his first day in office, Trump reinstated Cuba's designation as a so-called state sponsor of terrorism after President Biden removed Cuba from the list when his term ended. Meanwhile, Rubio has now shifted his focus to target Cuba's medical program that primarily sends Cuban doctors and healthcare workers to assist other countries, including disaster sites and during disease outbreaks. Rubio's accused the Cuban government of forced labor and earlier this month announced several Central American government officials who the U.S. says are linked to Cuba's medical assistance program will face visa restrictions. This all comes as the Trump administration's reportedly planning to transfer thousands of immigrants to Guantanamo to be detained there. Just last week, Trump's Homeland Security Department ordered over 500,000 immigrants from Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Venezuela to self-deport or face arrest after stripping them of their humanitarian parole status, which authorized them to temporarily live and work in the U.S. For more, we're joined here in New York studio by Carlos Fernandez de Cosío. He is Cuba's deputy foreign minister. He just addressed the U.N. General Assembly yesterday, where he again demanded the U.S. lift the catastrophic embargo on Cuba. Welcome back to Democracy Now! We last spoke to you before Trump's second term. If you can start off by talking about your demands at the U.N. yesterday.
Well, thank you for having me. Yesterday, the U.N. had a special session for an item in the agenda of the General Assembly, which is the rejection of unilateral coercive measures. So we were invited to speak, and our main message that we took is that the measures that the U.S. take against Cuba go beyond a simple coercive measure or a simple commercial embargo. It's the aim of isolating Cuba or blocking Cuba from the international community and from international economic and trade activity, which has been the aim for a long time, to try to choke the Cuban economy. And that was the main message yesterday, where, by the way, a resolution was adopted by the General Assembly designating December 4th of every year UN Day against the use of unilateral coercive measures.
Deputy Foreign Minister, can you talk about the annual vote that occurs at the General Assembly on this issue, where usually it's just the United States and Israel as practically the only nations in the world that continue to support the U.S. embargo?
You're correct. Since 1992, there have been resolutions by the U.N. General Assembly demanding the lifting of the U.S. economic blockade against Cuba. And as you say, only the United States, Israel, and every now and then some other state reject this resolution. It's a long call by the UN, which the United States simply disrespects.
And now that the Trump administration has elevated a Cuban-American from Florida, Marco Rubio, as Secretary of State, what has that meant in terms of U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America?
It means that there's a presence and an influence of anti-Cuban politicians in the U.S., which is, there's an increase in their influence greater than any previous moment, and allows them to push this narrow approach, which is not relevant to the interest of most Americans, and this narrow approach against Cuba and against other countries in the region.
I want to play for you Secretary of State Marco Rubio taking questions during a joint news conference in March with the Jamaican Prime Minister Andrew Holness in Jamaica.
It's not that they're Cuban doctors. It's that the regime does not pay these doctors, takes away their passports, and basically it is, in many ways, forced labor. And that we cannot be in support of. Again, not speaking about here in particular, but in general about the program.
If you can respond to Marco Rubio's allegations.
He has been, for several years, since he was a senator, attacking Cuba's medical programs around the world that most people know have been able to deploy more doctors in third world countries than the World Health Organization. He has tried to discredit it, beginning by saying that they were spies, that they were political officials, not doctors. He has changed course. Now he's saying that they're slaves. And he alleges a set of ideas which are absurd, because what the program is very similar to any program taken by U.S. organizations, European organizations, or even U.N. agencies when they carry out support in terms of how they hire the doctors, how they are paid, how they are provided for, and how they perform their tasks.
I want to ask you about the group of migrants that were supposedly en route while they were being deported from the United States to South Sudan. Two of them were from Cuba. We have reports of them being kept in a truck container along with the ICE guards that are guarding them. They were stopped by a judge, so they're in Djibouti. But if you can talk about the deportations and if Cuba is accepting deportation flights now that the U.S. has stripped those who are here on humanitarian grounds from being here.
we have with the U.S. bilateral migration agreements that go back to the 1980s. And within them, it includes regular deportation flights for people that the United States considers are inadmissible in the United States. And that continues to go on today. But the real picture here is the hundreds of thousands of Cubans that have come to the U.S. invited by the government. It is known that there has been for decades a policy of privileged flexibility for Cubans. So now you take this great mass of Cubans, which have been invited. They didn't have to tear down a wall to enter the United States. And now the government changes their mind and tells them, no, now you have to return. These are not furniture. This is not cattle. These are real human beings. And migrating is a dramatic decision, that have taken the decision to come here, have a family here, have a job here, and now the U.S. tells them that they have to go back. We find it very cruel. We've expressed it to the U.S. government. We've said it publicly. And we think we find that the politicians, some of them very hostile to Cuba, that have invited these people are now silent and are complicit with their expulsion to Cuba or to another country.
And Deputy Foreign Minister, I wanted to ask you about some reports over the last year or two in right-wing media outlets in the United States, but also some in more establishment media like the BBC and El País from Spain, that there have been hundreds of Cubans fighting as soldiers for Russia in Ukraine, and some are alleging that the Cuban government is backing this. I'm wondering if you could clarify the position of Cuba on this issue.
This became public in August of 2023, and it was Cuba that made it public when we found that there was a network coming out of Russia and coming out of Ukraine and other countries trying to recruit soldiers for that war for both sides. And we were very firm on it. We made it public. We spoke with the Russian embassy, we spoke with the Ukrainian embassy, and we said that this is unacceptable. And we've been very clear that by going to any other country and to try to fight as a soldier from Cuba, you are breaking the law in Cuba. So Cuba has a strong position. We know that there have been found people both on the Russian side and on the Ukrainian side, which are Cubans or of Cuban origin, but it's not, absolutely not something that Cuba is encouraging or where the Cuban government is participating.
Deputy Foreign Minister, can you respond to what's happening now between Israel and Iran? I know that the foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, has publicly condemned Israel's actions in Gaza, if you can talk about Gaza as well.
Our president and our foreign minister and our government in general has put a very strong condemnation of Israel's unilateral attack against Iran, and for the targeted assassinations that it has carried out. We have been very clear that we reject that. We see it as part of Israel's aggressive role in the region, and it's a follow-up of the genocide that it's committing against the people of Palestine.
And I'm wondering also if you could comment on the continued use of the U.S. government of Guantanamo as its sort of its own this place outside U.S. law where it can do whatever it wants and ship people in as prisoners onto the Guantanamo base?
The Guantanamo base is a U.S. military enclave in territory that it has taken from Cuba. It is Cuban territory, as recognized by the U.S., but the presence there is against the will of the Cuban people, and we demand for that base to be removed from it. Now, its use for housing criminals, as is done for many years. It's used for taking migrants and putting them there. We also reject it because of the inhuman treatment that they receive, but also because a great amount of individuals housed there by the U.S. government or imprisoned there. It's a danger to peace. That is a highly militarized zone. It's a danger for peace and tranquility in Cuba and for the countries of the region.
Could Cubans be deported from the United States to Guantanamo?
Well, not from the U.S. government. It seems that they think that they can do anything. I don't know if they have deported any Cuban to the base in Guantanamo. We know that they are deporting Cubans to Cuba on regular flights, but we don't know of any Cuba that has reached there.
We just have 20 seconds. We started with the embargo. Let's end the sanctions. What's the actual effect on people of Cuba?
It's a huge effect. It influences daily life, the standard of living, the tranquility, the peace of people. And it is the aim of these coercive measures, to make life as difficult as possible for the Cuban people so that they can have political goals.
Carlos Fernandez de Cossío, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Cuba's deputy foreign minister. We'll be doing an interview in Spanish and posting it online at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
I don't think I should improvise, man. It's not like sitting at home, I can tell you that. It's not like playing at home by yourself.
Well, what can we do for you?